I'm Helen Pease, and we're here today on Cybershow Reflections to discuss some great writings on cybersecurity, digital rights, and computer science. Today we're reading from Marcus Renum's Six Dumbest Ideas in Computer Security. Marcus is credited as being the inventor of the proxy firewall and wrote this article in 2005. Almost 20 years later, many of the problems remain not just unsolved, but comprehensively worse. In this part, we're covering part two and talking about enumerating badness.
Dumb idea number two.
Number two.
Enumerating badness. Back in the early days of computer security, there were only a relatively small number of well-known security holes. That had a lot to do with the widespread adoption of default permit, because when there were only 15 well-known ways to hack into a network, it was possible to individually examine and think about those 15 attack vectors and to block them. So security practitioners got into the habit of enumerating badness. That is, listing all of the bad things that we know about. Once you have listed all the badness, then you can put things in place to detect it or block it. Why is, quote, enumerating badness a dumb idea? It's a dumb idea because sometime around 1992, the amount of badness on the internet began to vastly outweigh the amount of goodness. For every harmless, legitimate application, there are dozens or hundreds of pieces of malware, worm tests, exploits, or viral code. Examine any typical antivirus package, and you'll see it knows about 75,000 plus viruses that might infect your machine. And you can see it's rather dumb to try to track 750,000 pieces of badness, even when a simpleton could track 30 pieces of goodness. In fact, if I were to simply track the 30 pieces of goodness on my machine and allow nothing else to run, I would have simultaneously solved the following problems: all spyware, all viruses, all remote control trojans, and all exploits that involve executing pre-installed code that you don't use regularly. Thanks to all the marketing hype around disclosing and announcing vulnerabilities, there are, according to some industry analysts, between 200 and 700 new pieces of badness hitting the internet every month. Not only is enumerating badness a dumb idea, it's getting dumber during the few minutes of your time you've bequeathed me by reading this article. Now, your typical IT executive, when I discuss this concept with him or her, will stand up and say something like, "That sounds great, but our enterprise network is really complicated. Knowing all about the different apps that we rely on would be impossible. What you're saying sounds reasonable until you think about it and realise how absurd it really is." To which I respond, "How can you call yourself a chief technology officer if you have no idea what your technology is doing? A CTO isn't going to know detail about every application on the network, but if you haven't got a vague idea what's going on, it's impossible to do capacity planning, disaster planning, security planning, or virtually any of the things in a CTO's charter." In 1994, I wrote a firewall product that needed some system log analysis routines that would alert the administrator in case some kind of unexpected condition was detected. The first version used enumerating badness. Sure, I've been dumb too. But the second version used what I've termed artificial ignorance, a process whereby you throw away the log entries you know are not interesting. If there's anything left after you've thrown away the stuff you know is not interesting, then the leftovers must be interesting. This approach worked amazingly well, and detected a number of very interesting operational conditions and errors that it simply never would have occurred to me to look for. Enumerating badness is the idea behind a huge number of security products and systems, from antivirus to intrusion detection, intrusion prevention, application security, and deep packet inspection firewalls. What these programs and devices do is outsource your process of knowing what's good. Instead of you taking the time to list the 30 or so legitimate things you need to do, it's easier to pay $29.99 a year to someone else who will try to maintain an exhaustive list of all the evil in the world. Except, unfortunately, your badness expert will get $29.99 a year for the antivirus list, another $29.99 a year for the spyware list, and then you'll buy another $19.99 personal firewall package that has application control for networks and so on. By the time you're done paying other people to enumerate all the malware your system could come into contact with, you'll more than double the cost of your, quote, inexpensive desktop operating system. One clear symptom that you have a bad case of enumerating badness is that you've got a system or software that needs signature updates on a regular basis, or a system that lets past a new worm that it hasn't seen before. The cure for enumerating badness is, of course, enumerating goodness. Amazingly, there is virtually no support in operating systems for such software-level controls. I've tried using Windows XP Pro's program execution control, but it's oriented towards enumerating badness and is itself a dumb implementation of a dumb idea. In a sense, enumerating badness is a special dumb case of default permit, our number one dumb computer security idea. But it's so prevalent that it's in a class all by itself.
We're here today on Cybershow Reflections to discuss some great writings on cybersecurity, digital rights, and computer science. Ed, what do you think of that?
Enumerating badness is such a wide scope these days, and there's hundreds and hundreds of ways to analyse badness in systems. Bearing in mind this paper was released in 2005, 18 years ago now, and in modern cybersecurity practice, the approach of enumerating badness has evolved significantly, essentially because they had to. The threat landscape has evolved so rapidly, especially in the last 5-10 years. So I'm just going to go through some common approaches that are used today and some examples for them. Essentially the way that the industry is enumerating badness in 2023. I've narrowed down enumerating badness methods into 8 core categories, which are threat intelligence, user and entity behavior analytics platforms, sandboxing and dynamic analysis, honeypots and honeynets, threat hunting, machine learning and AI, security information and event management systems, and collaborative threat intelligence sharing. On the front of threat intelligence, organizations are leveraging threat intelligence feeds from various sources. We've got cybersecurity vendors, government agencies, and also research institutions. So these feeds provide up-to-date information about known malicious IP addresses, domains, file hashes, and other indicators of compromise, also known as IOCs. Security teams use this intelligence to block or alert suspicious activities. I mean, some great examples of this would be the open source threat intelligence feeds, such as the Open Threat Exchange, also known as OTX, by AlienVault, and they provide up-to-date information on known malicious IP addresses, domains, and indicators of compromise. And on the commercial front, there are threat intelligence providers such as FireEye, Recorded Future, and CrowdStrike, and they all offer comprehensive threat intelligence feeds, which organizations can leverage to enhance their own security defenses. Now, the role of behavioral analytics is essentially, instead of relying solely on signature-based detection. Behavioral analytics focuses on understanding normal patterns of user and system behavior. Machine learning algorithms and advanced analytics techniques are employed to detect abnormalities and potential indicators of compromise based on deviations from the expected behaviors. So, user and entity behavior analytics platforms such as Splunk User Behavior Analytics and Exabeam use machine learning algorithms to detect abnormalities in user behavior that may indicate potential insider threats or compromised accounts. Network behavior analysis tools like Darktrace and Vectra analyze network traffic patterns to identify abnormal behaviors, for example, lateral movement or data exfiltration. Moving on to sandbox and dynamic analysis. So, sandboxing involves running suspicious files or executables in isolated environments to observe their behavior. Dynamic analysis techniques monitor the behavior of the executed code, such as file system changes, network communications, and system calls, to detect malicious activity that may not be identified at a static analysis. Some example tools with this functionality are Cuckoo Sandbox and Palo Alto Networks Wildfire, which use sandboxing techniques to analyze suspicious files and identify malware behavior, including command and control communication and malicious activities. Hybrid-analysis.com is a public platform where individuals and organizations can submit files for dynamic analysis in a sandboxed environment. So most people have heard of honeypots, which are decoy systems designed to attract and deceive attackers. Now, by monitoring the activity on these intentionally vulnerable systems, security professionals can gather valuable information about attack techniques, identify newer threats, and gain insights into attacker behavior. Honeynets are essentially networks of interconnected honeypots that provide a broader scope for analysis. The HoneyNet project is an open source initiative that deploys honeypots worldwide to capture and analyze the tactics, techniques, and procedures used by attackers. There's also Canary tokens, such as those provided by Canary Tools, which are lightweight honeypots that can simulate various types of assets such as files, documents, credentials, etc. And these can be placed strategically to attract and detect attackers. And there's also threat hunting, which involves proactively searching for threats or signs of malicious activity within a network and systems. It typically involves the use of advanced security tools, log analysis, and data correlation techniques to identify indicators of compromise or potential security incidents that may have evaded traditional defenses. And there's also a range of machine learning and AI algorithms which are used to analyze vast amounts of security-related data, such as log files, network traffic, user behavior, all to identify patterns, abnormalities, and potential threats. Now, these technologies can automate the process of enumerating badness by continually learning from new data and adapting to emerging threats. Now, this is already being used in a range of applications, such as Cisco's Cognitive Threat Analytics, which uses machine learning to detect and analyze anomalous network behavior patterns indicative of advanced threats. Security Information and Event Management Systems, known as SIEM, collect and correlate data from various sources, including logs, network traffic, and security devices. They apply rule-based analysis and correlation algorithms to identify and alert on suspicious activities or events that indicate potential security incidents. Some examples of this are Splunk Enterprise Security and IBM Q Radar, LogRhythms Next Gen SIEM, just to name a few. And finally, collaborative threat intelligence sharing. Organizations share threat intelligence with trusted partners, industry peers, and the information sharing communities to collectively improve their defense capabilities. This collaborative approach allows for faster identification and response to emerging threats, which benefits the broader cybersecurity community. The Cyber Threat Alliance, CTA, is a non-profit organization where security vendors and organizations share threat intelligence to improve defenses collectively. The Information Sharing and Analysis Centers, ISCAs, such as the Financial Services, ISAC, and the Health Information Sharing and Analysis Center, HISAC, facilitate industry-specific threat intelligence sharing among members. By combining multiple techniques and leveraging advanced technologies, yourself or your organization can enhance your ability to detect and enumerate badness effectively.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk. Andy, what do you think of that?
That's a great response, Ed, and one that shows the distance that we've travelled since 2005 and how a more complex landscape allows the idea to exist in myriad new forms. I'd like to unpack it a bit and criticise some aspects in both negative and positive ways. Let's start with threat intelligence. I'm quite sure that I've said this elsewhere, that security and intelligence are closely related, but aren't the same thing. And we make a mistake to suppose that there's a causation, or even a strong correlate, between good intel and good security. But hey, let us suppose that good intel did imply good security, and see what still remains as problematic. The first is probably equity. I remember back in the early days of shared intel networks with Spam House and the like, that there was a very public-spirited, egalitarian justification to maintaining these sorts of public lists. But as these concerns get commercialised, because obviously it costs money to run a rack full of servers, some people get cut in and some people get cut out. The question is, can you afford good intel? And thus, can you afford good security? And for the losers who can't afford it, there's kind of two sub-issues at play here. The first is a kind of game theoretical, which is that security is not localised in self-interests. Your neighbour's security has a direct effect on yours. If the neighbourhood goes to crap, then you've still got to live in it, surrounded by your Ring doorbells and razor wire. We're in it together. And so to speak of a, quote, security advantage or a competitive security market is a real debasement of common goals. The second, which sort of arises from the first, is an ideological or philosophical claim that everybody deserves good security. And if security is not so much the state of your machine, the endpoint, but the state of the network, i.e. what's out there, the neighbourhood, then everybody living on the same street deserves equal protection by the police.
Today we're reading from Marcus Renum's Six Dumbest Ideas in Computer Security with Ed Navard, Helen Pease and Andy Farnell. Andy?
Well, if you're going to have that free and equal access, you need open published data. And obviously what you publish is signalled back to the actors that you're monitoring, allowing them to adapt. So this raises the question of secrecy and digital privilege. Which brings us to the next point. I chose the word police quite deliberately there, because that is very much what these organisations become. There's a long history of problems with vigilantism and gangs, and ideas that go back to David Hume, Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and of course Sir Robert Peel, which say that if you're going to have this sort of thing, it requires universal consent and universal access through some sort of social security contract, or you will end up with greater injustice and a net reduction of security. Ultimately, you end up with only one police force, which sort of bodes that this affair ends up under some kind of state umbrella. But weirdly, we see that orgs ostensibly charged with that task, like the NSA, GCHQ and our pretty new NCSC, are more or less silent. And there's a very strange and uncomfortable dynamic around threat intelligence sharing. And at the root of that, I think, is this infinite regress, which we can easily identify as who judges the judges. Now, the history of blacklisting is checkered, to say the least. The main thing being, they inevitably get abused. They're there in employment in almost every industry, like Hollywood's exclusion of suspected communists, bans on the un-Americans, just even credit scores. And any big data set to which you can attach a key score for prejudicial use is open to abuse. The Nazis, the Stasi, and probably every secret police and secret to power block in history has got their own little black book. I think the best way to describe my sentiments on this is just to be terribly British about it and say it's unsavoury, ungentlemanly and unsportsmanlike. Though, of course, speaking as a Brit, we have things like the Economic League and we more or less invented the idea of concentration camps for undesirables. So I say it with the full force of absolute hypocrisy. Nonetheless, I think when you look at the intractability of keeping up with a fire hose of information, which is growing and is now subject to the epistemological crises of generative AI, attribution engineering and disinfo, it rather amplifies Renoum's point that you'd be better off just being secure in the first place. If you're Chuck Norris, you don't need to care about what neighbourhood you're walking through or what anybody says about it. From a more positive point of view, though, Ed, I think the proliferation of intelligence tools that you mentioned that track badness in some way indicates a shift in cybersecurity from the endpoint to the network and then ultimately to OPSEC and Layer 8 concerns. It's become much more about who rather than what they're doing. And so I think this movement from a technical to a psychological and political landscape is very interesting in itself. I think technically, yes, we can have security, but the question that's emerging through this ecosystem of stuff is, are these three essential questions we must always come back to. Security for who? Security from who or what? And security to what ends?
Time on the Cyber Show, part 3, talking about penetrate and patch. I'm Helen Bees, signing off for the Cyber Show.